Land is a man's business. Henry was still sleeping. In the weeks that followed, he slept a great deal, and I let him, although in an ordinary summer I would have filled his days with chores once school let out. And he would have filled his evenings either visiting over at Cottery's or walking up and down our dirt road with Shannon, the two of them holding hands and watching the moon rise. When they weren't kissing, that was. I hoped what we'd done had not spoiled such sweet pastimes for him, but believed it had. That I had. And of course I was right. I cleared my mind of such thoughts, telling myself it was enough for now that he was sleeping. I had to make another visit to the well, and it would be best to do it alone. Our stripped bed seemed to shout murder. I went to the closet and studied her clothes. Women have so many, don't they? Skirts and dresses and blouses and sweaters and underthings. Some of the latter so complicated and strange a man can't even tell which side is the front. To take them all would be a mistake, because the truck was still parked in the barn and the Model T under the elm. She had left on foot and taken only what she could carry. Why hadn't she taken the T? Because I would have heard it start and stopped her going. That was believable enough, so? A single valise. I packed it with what I thought a woman would need, and what she could not bear to leave. I put in her few pieces of good jewelry and the gold-framed picture of her mama and papa. I debated over the toiletries in the bathroom and decided to leave everything except for her atomizer bottle of Florient perfume and her horn-backed brush. There was a testament in her night table given to her by Pastor Hawkins, but I'd never seen her read it, and so left it where it was. But I took the bottle of iron pills, which she kept for her monthlies. Henry was still sleeping, but now tossing from side to side as if in the grip of bad dreams. I hurried about my business as quickly as I could, wanting to be in the house when he woke up. I went around the barn to the well, put the valise down, and lifted the splintery old cap for the third time. Thank God Henry wasn't with me. Thank God he didn't see what I saw. I think it would have driven him insane. It almost drove me insane. The mattress had been shunted aside. My first thought was that she had pushed it away before trying to climb out, because she was still alive. She was breathing! Or so it seemed to me at first. Then, just as ratiocinative ability began to resurface through my initial shock, when I began to ask myself what sort of breathing might cause a woman's dress to rise and fall not just at the bosom, but all the way from neckline to hem, her jaw began to move, as if she were struggling to talk. It was not words that emerged from her greatly enlarged mouth, however, but the rat which had been chewing on the delicacy of her tongue. Its tail appeared first. Then her lower jaw yawned wider as it backed out, the claws on its back feet digging into her chin for purchase. The rat plopped into her lap, and when it did, a great flood of its brothers and sisters poured out from under her dress. One had something white caught in its whiskers, a fragment of her slip, or perhaps her skimmies. I chucked the valise at them. I didn't think about it. My mind was roaring with revulsion and horror, but just did it. It landed on her legs. Most of the rodents, perhaps all, avoided it nimbly enough. Then they streamed into a round black hole that the mattress, which they must have pushed aside through sheer weight of numbers, had covered, and were gone in a trice. I knew well enough what that hole was, the mouth of the pipe that had supplied water to the troughs in the barn until the water level sank too low and rendered it useless. Her dress collapsed around her. The counterfeit breathing stopped, but she was staring at me, and what had seemed a clown's grin now looked like a gorgon's glare. I could see rat bites on her cheeks, and one of her earlobes was gone. "Dear God," I whispered. "Arlette, I'm so sorry." Your apology is not accepted, her glare seemed to say. And when they find me like this, with rat bites on my dead face and the underwear beneath my dress chewed away, you'll ride the lightning over in Lincoln, for sure. And mine will be the last face you see. You'll see me when the electricity fries your liver and sets fire to your heart. And I'll be grinning. I lowered the cap and staggered to the barn. There my legs betrayed me, and if I'd been in the sun, I surely would have passed out the way Henry had the night before. But I was in the shade, and after I sat for 5 minutes with my head lowered almost to my knees, I began to feel myself again. The rats had gotten to her. So what? Don't they get to all of us in the end? The rats and bugs? Sooner or later, even the stoutest coffin must collapse and let in life to feed on death. It's the way of the world. And what did it matter? When the heart stops and the brain asphyxiates, our spirits either go somewhere else or simply wink out. Either way, we aren't there to feel the gnawing as our flesh is eaten from our bones. I started for the house and had reached the porch steps before a thought stopped me. What about the twitch? What if she'd been alive when I threw her into the well? What if she'd still been alive, paralyzed, unable to move so much as one of her slashed fingers when the rats came out of the pipe and began their depredations? What if she had felt the one that had squirmed into her conveniently enlarged mouth and began to... No, I whispered. She didn't feel it because she didn't twitch. Never did. She was dead when I threw her in. Papa? Henry called in a sleep, muzzy voice. Pop, is that you? Yes. Who are you talking to? No one. Myself. I went in. He was sitting at the kitchen table in his singlet and undershorts, looking dazed and unhappy. His hair standing up in cowlicks reminded me of the tyke he had once been, laughing and chasing the chickens around the dooryard with his hound dog, Boo, long dead by that summer, at his heels. I wish we hadn't done it, he said as I sat down opposite him. Done is done and can't be undone, I said. How many times have I told you that, boy? About a million. He lowered his head for a few moments, then looked up at me. His eyes were red-rimmed and bloodshot. Are we going to be caught? Are we going to jail? Or... No. I've got a plan. You had a plan that it wouldn't hurt her. Look how that turned out. My hand itched to slap him for that, so I held it down with the other. This was not the time for recriminations. Besides, he was right. Everything that had gone wrong was my fault. Except for the rats, I thought. They are not my fault. But they were. Of course they were. If not for me, she would have been at the stove putting on supper. Probably going on and on about those 100 acres. Yes. But alive and well, instead of in the well... The rats are probably back already, a voice deep in my mind whispered. Eating her. They'll finish the good parts, the tasty parts, the delicacies, and then... Henry reached across the table to touch my knotted hands. I started. I'm sorry, he said. We're in it together. I loved him for that. We're going to be all right, Hank. If we keep our heads, we'll be fine. Now listen to me. He listened. At some point he began to nod. When I finished, he asked me one question. When were we going to fill in the well? Not yet, I said. Isn't that risky? Yes, I said. 2 days later, while I was mending a piece of fence about a quarter mile from the farm, I saw a large cloud of dust boiling down our road from the Omaha-Lincoln Highway. We were about to have a visit from the world that Arlette had so badly wanted to be a part of. I walked back to the house with my hammer tucked into a belt loop and my carpenter's apron around my waist, its long pouch full of jingling nails. Henry was not in view. Perhaps he'd gone down to the spring to bathe. Perhaps he was in his room, sleeping. By the time I got to the dooryard and sat on the chopping block, I'd recognized the vehicle pulling the rooster tail. Lars Olson's Red Baby Delivery Truck. Lars was the Hemmingford home blacksmith and village milkman. He would also, for a price, serve as a kind of chauffeur. And it was that function he was fulfilling on this June afternoon. The truck pulled into the dooryard, putting George, our bad-tempered rooster, and his little harem of chickens to flight. Before the motor had even finished coughing itself to death, a portly man, wrapped in a flapping gray duster, got out on the passenger side. He pulled off his goggles to reveal large and comical white circles around his eyes. "Wilfred James?" "At your service," I said, getting up. I felt calm enough. I might have felt less so if he'd come out in the county Ford with the star on the side. "You are?" "Andrew Lester," he said, "attorney at law." He put his hand out. I considered it. "Before I shake that, you'd better tell me whose lawyer you are, Mr. Lester." "I'm currently being retained by the Farrington Livestock Company of Chicago, Omaha, and Des Moines." "Yes," I thought, "I've no doubt. But I'll bet your name isn't even on the door. The big boys back in Omaha don't have to eat country dust to pay for their daily bread, do they? The big boys have got their feet up on their desks, drinking coffee and admiring the pretty ankles of their secretaries." I said, "In that case, sir, why don't you just go on and put that hand away? No offense." He did just that, and with a lawyer's smile. Sweat was cutting clean lines down his chubby cheeks, and his hair was all matted and tangled from the ride. I walked past him to Lars, who'd thrown up the wing over his engine and was fiddling with something inside. He was whistling and sounded just as happy as a bird on a wire. I envied him that. I thought Henry and I might have another happy day. In a world as varied as this one, anything is possible. But it would not be in the summer of 1922, or the fall. I shook Lars's hand and asked how he was.
"Tolerable fare," he said, "but dry. I could use a drink."
I nodded toward the east side of the house.
"You know where it is."
"I do,"
he said, slamming down the wing with a metallic clatter that sent the chickens who'd been creeping back into flight once more.
"Sweet and cold as ever, I guess."
"I'd say so," I agreed, thinking, "but if you could still pump from that other well, Lars, I don't think you'd care for the taste at all."
"Try it and see."
He started around to the shady side of the house where the outside pump stood, in its little shelter. Mr. Lester watched him go, then turned back to me. He had unbuttoned his duster. The suit beneath would need dry cleaning when he got back to Lincoln, Omaha, DeLand, or wherever he hung his hat when he wasn't doing Cole Farrington's business. "I could use a drink myself, Mr. James."
"Me too. Nailing fence is hot work."
I looked him up and down.
"Not as hot as riding 20 miles in Lars's truck, though, I'll bet."
He rubbed his butt and smiled his lawyer's smile. This time it had a touch of rue in it. I could see his eyes already flicking here, there, and everywhere. It would not do to sell this man short just because he'd been ordered to rattle 20 miles out into the country on a hot summer's day. "My sit-upon may never be the same." There was a dipper chained to the side of the little shelter. Lars pumped it full, drank it down with his Adam's apple rising and falling in his scrawny, sunburned neck, then filled it again and offered it to Lester, who looked at it as doubtfully as I'd looked at his outstretched hand.
"Perhaps we could drink it inside, Mr. James. It would be a little cooler."
"It would," I agreed.
"But I'd no more invite you inside than I'd shake your hand."
Lars Olson saw how the wind was blowing and wasted no time going back to his truck. But he handed the dipper to Lester first. My visitor didn't drink in gulps, as Lars had, but in fastidious sips, like a lawyer, in other words. But he didn't stop until the dipper was empty, and I was also like a lawyer. The screen door slammed and Henry came out of the house in his overalls and bare feet. He gave us a glance that seemed utterly disinterested. Good boy. And then went where any red-blooded country lad would have gone. To watch Lars work on his truck and, if he were lucky, to learn something. I sat down on the woodpile we kept under a swatch of canvas on this side of the house. I imagine you're out here on business? My wife's? I am. Well, you've had your drink, so we better get down to it. I've still got a full day's work ahead of me, and it's 3 in the afternoon. Sunrise to sunset. Farming's a hard life. He sighed as if he knew. It is, and a difficult wife can make it even harder. She sent you, I suppose, but I don't know why. If it was just some legal paperwork, I reckon a sheriff's deputy would have come out and served it on me. He looked at me in surprise. Your wife didn't send me, Mr. James. In point of fact, I came out here to look for her. It was like a play, and this was my cue to look puzzled, then to chuckle, because chuckling came next in the stage directions. That just proves it. Proves what? When I was a boy in Fortis, we had a neighbor, a nasty old rip named Bradley. Everyone called him Pop Bradley. Mr. James. My father had to do business with him from time to time, and sometimes he took me with him. Back in the buckboard days, this was. Seed corn was what their trading was mostly about, at least in the spring, but sometimes they also swapped tools. There was no mail order back then, and a good tool might circle the whole county before it got back home. Mr. James, I hardly see the rel— And every time we went to see that old fellow, my mama told me to plug my ears, because every other word that came out of Pop Bradley's mouth was a cuss or something filthy. In a sour sort of way, I was starting to enjoy this. So naturally, I listened all the harder. I remember that one of Pop's favorite sayings was, "Never mount a mare without a bridle, because you can never tell which way a bitch will run." Am I supposed to understand that? Which way do you suppose my bitch ran, Mr. Lester? Are you telling me your wife is absconded, Mr. Lester? Decamped? Took French leave? Did a midnight flit? As an avid reader and student of American slang, such terms occur naturally to me. Lars, however, and most other town folks will just say, "She ran off and left him," when the word gets around. Or, "him and the boy," in this case. I naturally thought she would have gone to her hog-fancying friends at the Farrington Company, and the next I heard from her would have been a notice that she was selling her father's acreage. As she means to do. Has she signed it over yet? Because I guess I'd have to go to law if she has. As a matter of fact, she hasn't. But when she does, I would advise you against the expense of a legal action. You would surely lose. I stood up. One of my overall straps had fallen off my shoulder, and I hooked it back into place with a thumb. Well, since she's not here, it's what the legal profession calls a moot question, wouldn't you say? I'd look in Omaha if I were you. I smiled. Or St. Louis. She was always talking about St. Lou. It sounds to me as if she got as tired of you fellows as she did of me. And the son she gave birth to. Said good riddance to bad rubbish. A plague on both your houses. That's Shakespeare, by the way, Romeo and Juliet. A play about love. You'll pardon me for saying, but all this seems very strange to me, Mr. James. He had produced a silk handkerchief from a pocket inside his suit. I bet traveling lawyers like him have lots of pockets. And began to mop his face with it. His cheeks were now not just flushed, but bright red. It wasn't the heat of the day that had turned his face that color. Very strange indeed, considering the amount of money my client is willing to pay for that piece of property, which is contiguous with Hemingford Stream and close to the Great Western Rail Line. It's going to take some getting used to on my part as well. But I have the advantage of you. Yes? I know her.
I'm sure you and your clients thought you had a deal all made. But Arlette James, let's just say that nailing her down to something is like trying to nail jelly to the floor. We need to remember what Pop Bradley said, Mr. Lester. Why, the man was a countrified genius. Could I look in the house? I laughed again, and this time it wasn't forced. The man had gall, I'll give him that. And not wanting to go back empty-handed was understandable. He'd ridden 20 miles in a dusty truck with no doors. He had 20 more to bounce across before he got back to Hemingford City. And a train ride after that, no doubt. He had a sore ass. And the people who'd sent him out here weren't going to be happy with his report when he finally got to the end of all that hard traveling. Poor feller. I'll ask you one back. Could you drop your pants so I could look at your ghoulie bits? I find that offensive. I don't blame you. Think of it as a, not a simile, that's not right, but a kind of parable. I don't understand you. Well, you've got an hour back to the city to think it over. Two, if Lars's red baby throws a tire. And I can assure you, Mr. Lester, that if I did let you poke around through my house, my private place, my castle, my ghoulie bits, you wouldn't find my wife's body in the closet or... There was a terrible moment when I almost said, or down the well. I felt sweat spring out on my forehead. Or under the bed.
I never said...
Henry! I called. Come over here a minute. Henry came with his head down and his feet dragging in the dust. He looked worried, maybe even guilty, but that was all right. Yes, sir? Tell this man, where's your mama? I don't know. When you called me to breakfast Friday morning, she was gone. Packed and gone. Lester was looking at him keenly.
Son, is that the truth?
Yes, sir.
The whole truth and nothing but the truth. So help you God.
Papa, can I go back in the house? I've got schoolwork to make up from being sick. Go on, then, I said, but don't be slow. Remember, it's your turn to milk.
Yes, sir.
He trudged up the steps and inside. Lester watched him go, then turned back to me.
There's more here than meets the eye.
I see you wear no wedding ring, Mr. Lester. If there comes a time when you've worn one as long as I have, you'll know that in families there always is. And you'll know something else as well. You can never tell which way a bitch will run.
He got up. This isn't finished.
It is, I said, knowing it wasn't. But if things went all right, we were closer to the end than we had been. If. He started across the dooryard, then turned back. He used his silk handkerchief to mop off his face again, then said, If you think those 100 acres are yours just because you've scared your wife away, sent her packing to her aunt in Des Moines or a sister in Minnesota. Check Omaha, I said, smiling. Or St. Lou. She had no use for her relations. But she was crazy about the idea of living in St. Lou. God knows why. If you think you'll plant and harvest out there, you'd better think again. That land's not yours. If you so much as drop a seed there, you will be seeing me in court. I said, I'm sure you'll hear from her, as soon as she gets a bad case of bronchitis. What I wanted to say was, no, it's not mine. But it's not yours either. It's just going to sit there, and that's all right, because it will be mine in 7 years when I go to court to have her declared legally dead. I can wait. 7 years without smelling pig shit when the wind's out of the west. 7 years without hearing the screams of dying hogs, so much like the screams of a dying woman. Or seeing their intestines float down a creek that's red with blood. That sounds like an excellent 7 years to me. Have yourself a fine day, Mr. Lester, and mind the sun going back. It gets pretty fierce in the late afternoon, and it'll be right in your face. He got into the truck without replying. Lars waved to me, and Lester snapped at him. Lars gave him a look that might have meant, snap and yap all you want, it's still 20 miles back to Hemingford City.
When they were gone, except for the rooster tail of dust, Henry came back out on the porch. "Did I do it right, Papa?" I took his wrist, gave it a squeeze, and pretended not to feel the flesh tighten momentarily under my hand as if he had to override an impulse to pull away. "Just right. Perfect. Are we going to fill in the well tomorrow?" I thought about this carefully because our lives might depend on what I decided. Sheriff Jones was getting on in years and up in pounds. He wasn't lazy, but it was hard to get him moving without a good reason. Lester would eventually convince Jones to come out here, but probably not until Lester got one of Cole Farrington's two hell-for-leather sons to call and remind the sheriff what company was the biggest taxpayer in Hemingford County, not to mention the neighboring counties of Clay, Fillmore, York, and Seward. Still, I thought we had at least 2 days. "Not tomorrow," I said. "The day after."
"Papa, why?"
"Because the high sheriff will be out here, and Sheriff Jones is old, but not stupid. A filled-in well might make him suspicious about why it got filled in, so recent and all, but one that's still being filled in, and for a good reason."
"What reason? Tell me."
"Soon," I said. "Soon." All the next day we waited to see dust boiling toward us down our road, not being pulled by Lars Olsen's truck, but by the county sheriff's car. It didn't come. What came was Shannon Cottery, looking pretty in a cotton blouse and gingham skirt, to ask if Henry was all right, and could he take supper with her and her mama and her papa if he was. Henry said he was fine, and I watched them go up the road hand in hand with deep misgivings. He was keeping a terrible secret, and terrible secrets are heavy. Wanting to share them is the most natural thing in the world, and he loved the girl, or thought he did, which comes to the same when you're just going on 15. To make things worse, he had a lie to tell, and she might know it was a lie. They say that loving eyes can never see, but that's a fool's axiom. Sometimes they see too much. I hoed in the garden, pulling up more peas than weeds, then sat on the porch, smoking a pipe and waiting for him to come back. Just before moonrise, he did. His head was down, his shoulders were slumped, and he was trudging rather than walking. I hated to see him that way, but I was still relieved. If he had shared his secret, or even part of it, he wouldn't have been walking like that. If he'd shared his secret, he might not have come back at all. "You told it the way we decided," I asked him when he sat down.
"The way you decided?"
"Yes." "And she promised not to tell her folks?"
"Yes."
"But will she?"
He sighed.
"Probably yes. She loves them and they love her. They'll see something in her face, I reckon, and get it out of her. And even if they don't, she'll probably tell the sheriff. If he bothers to talk to the Cotteries at all, that is."
"Lester will see that he does. He'll bark at Sheriff Jones because his bosses in Omaha are barking at him. Round and round it goes, and where it stops, nobody knows."
"We never should have done it," he considered, then said it again in a fierce whisper. I said nothing. For a while, neither did he. We watched the moon rise out of the corn, red and pregnant.
"Papa, can I have a glass of beer?"
I looked at him, surprised and not surprised. Then I went inside and poured us each a glass of beer. I gave one to him and said, "None of this tomorrow or the day after, mind."
"No."
He sipped, grimaced, then sipped again.
"I hated lying to Shan, Papa. Everything about this is dirty."
"Dirt washes off."
"Not this kind," he said, and took another sip.
This time, he didn't grimace.
A little while later, after the moon had gone to silver, I stepped around to use the privy and to listen to the corn and the night breeze tell each other the old secrets of the earth. When I got back to the porch, Henry was gone.
His glass of beer stood half-finished on the railing by the steps. Then I heard him in the barn saying, "Sue, boss, Sue." I went out to see. He had his arms around Elphys's neck and was stroking her. I believe he was crying. I watched for a while, but in the end said nothing. I went back to the house, undressed, and lay down in the bed where I'd cut my wife's throat. It was a long time before I went to sleep. And if you don't understand why, all the reasons why, then reading this is of no use to you. I had named all our cows after minor Greek goddesses, but Elphys turned out to be either a bad choice or an ironic joke. In case you don't remember the story of how evil came to our sad old world, let me refresh you. All the bad things flew out when Pandora gave in to her curiosity and opened the jar that had been left in her keeping. The only thing that remained when she regained enough wits to put the lid back on was Elphys, the goddess of hope. But in that summer of 1922, there was no hope left for our Elphys. She was old and cranky, no longer gave much milk, and we'd all but given up trying to get what little she had. As soon as you sat down on the stool, she'd try to kick you. We should have converted her into comestibles a year before, but I balked at the cost of having Harlan Cottery butcher her, and I was no good at slaughtering much beyond hogs, a self-assessment with which you, reader, must now surely agree. "And she'd be tough," Arlette said, who had shown a sneaking affection for Elphys, perhaps because she was never the one to milk her. "Better leave well enough alone." But now we had a use for Elphys in the well, as it so happened, and her death might serve an end far more useful than a few stringy cuts of meat. 2 days after Lester's visit, my son and I put a nose halter on her and led her around the side of the barn. Halfway to the well, Henry stopped. His eyes shone with dismay. "Papa, I smell her." "Go into the house, then, and get some cotton balls for your nose. They're on her dresser." Although his head was lowered, I saw the sidelong glance he shot me as he went. "This is all your fault," that look said. "All your fault because you couldn't let go." Yet I had no doubt that he would help me do the work that lay ahead. Whatever he now thought of me, there was a girl in the picture as well, and he didn't want her to know what he had done. I had forced him to do it, but she would never understand that. We led Elphys to the well cap, where she quite reasonably balked. We went around to the far side, holding the halter strings like ribbons in a maypole dance, and hauled her out onto the rotted wood by main force. The cap cracked beneath her weight, bowed down, but held. The old cow stood on it, head lowered, looking as stupid and as stubborn as ever, showing the greenish-yellow rudiments of her teeth. "What now?" Henry asked. I started to say I didn't know, and that was when the well cap broke in two with a loud and brittle snap. We held on to the halter strings, although I thought for a moment I was going to be dragged into that damned well with two dislocated arms. Then the nose rig ripped free and flew back up. It was split down both the sides. Below, Elphys began to low in agony and drum her hoofs against the well's rock sides. "Papa!" Henry screamed. His hands were fists against his mouth, the knuckles digging into his upper lip. "Make her stop!" Elphys uttered a long, echoing groan. Her hoofs continued to beat against the stone. I took Henry's arm and hauled him, stumbling, back to the house. I pushed him down on Arlette's mail-order sofa and ordered him to stay there until I came back to get him. "And remember, this is almost over." "It'll never be over," he said, and turned face down on the sofa. He put his hands over his ears, even though Elphys couldn't be heard from in here, except Henry still was hearing her. And so was I. I got my varmint gun from the high shelf in the pantry. It was only a .22, but it would do the job. And if Harlan heard shots rolling across the acres between his place and mine, that would fit our story, too. If Henry could keep his wits long enough to tell it, that was. Here is something I learned in 1922. There are always worse things waiting. You think you've seen the most terrible thing, the one that coalesces all your nightmares into a freakish horror that actually exists, and the only consolation is that there can be nothing worse. Even if there is, your mind will snap at the sight of it, and you will know no more. But there is worse. Your mind does not snap, and somehow you carry on. You might understand that all the joy has gone out of the world for you, that what you did has put all you hope to gain out of your reach. You might wish you were the one who was dead, but you go on. You realize that you are in a hell of your own making, but you go on nevertheless, because there's nothing else to do. Elphys had landed on top of my wife's body. But Arlette's grinning face was still perfectly visible, still tilted up to the sunlit world above, still seeming to look at me. And the rats had come back. The cow falling into their world had doubtless caused them to retreat into the pipe I would eventually come to think of as Rat Boulevard. But then they had smelled fresh meat and had come hurrying out to investigate. They were already nibbling at poor old Elphys as she lowed and kicked, more feebly now, and one sat on top of my dead wife's head like an eldritch crown. It had picked a hole in the burlap sack and pulled a tuft of her hair out with its clever claws. Arlette's cheeks, once so round and pretty, hung in shreds. "Nothing can be any worse than this," I thought. "Surely I've reached the end of horror." But yes, there are always worse things waiting. As I peered down, frozen with shock and revulsion, Elphys kicked out again and one of her hoofs connected with what remained of Arlette's face. There was a snap as my wife's jaw broke and everything below her nose shifted to the left as if on a hinge. Still, the ear-to-ear grin remained. That it was no longer aligned with her eyes made it even worse. It was as if she now had two faces to haunt me with instead of just one. Her body shifted against the mattress, making it slide. The rat on her head scurried down behind it. Elphys lowed again. I thought that if Henry came back now and looked into the well, he would kill me for making him a part of this. I probably deserved killing. But that would leave him alone, and alone he would be defenseless. Part of a cap had fallen into the well. Part of it was still hanging down. I loaded my rifle, rested it on this slope, and aimed at Elphys, who lay with her neck broken and her head cocked against the rock wall. I waited for my hands to steady, then pulled the trigger. One shot was enough. Back in the house, I found that Henry had gone to sleep on the couch. I was too shocked myself to consider this strange. At that moment, he seemed to me like the only truly hopeful thing in the world. Soiled, but not so filthy he could never be clean again. I bent and kissed his cheek. He moaned and turned his head away. I left him there and went to the barn for my tools. When he joined me 3 hours later, I had pulled the broken and hanging piece of the well cap out of the hole and had begun to fill it in. "I'll help," he said in a flat and dreary voice. "Good. Get the truck and drive it out to the dirt pile at West Fence." "By myself?" The disbelief in his voice was only faint, but I was encouraged to hear any emotion at all. "You know all the forward gears, and you can find reverse, can't you?"
"Yes."
"Then you'll be fine. I've got enough to be going on with in the meantime, and when you come back, the worst will be over." I waited for him to tell me again that the worst would never be over, but he didn't. I recommenced shoveling. I could still see the top of Arlette's head and the burlap with that terrible picked-over tuft sticking out of it. There might already be a litter of newborn ratlings down there in the cradle of my dead wife's thighs. I heard the truck cough once, then twice. I hoped the crank wouldn't kick back and break Henry's arm. The third time he turned the crank, our old truck bellowed into life. He retarded the spark, gunned the throttle a time or two, then drove away. He was gone for almost an hour, but when he came back, the truck's bed was full of rocks and soil. He drove it to the edge of the well and killed the engine. He had taken off his shirt, and his sweat-shiny torso looked too thin. I could count his ribs. I tried to think when I'd last seen him eat a big meal, and at first I couldn't. Then I realized it must have been breakfast on the morning after we'd done away with her. I'll see that he gets a good dinner tonight, I thought. I'll see that we both do. No beef, but there's pork in the icebox. Look yonder, he said in his new flat voice and pointed. I saw a rooster tail of dust coming toward us. I looked down into the well. It wasn't good enough, not yet. Half of Elphus was still sticking up. That was all right, of course, but the corner of the blood-stained mattress was also still poking out of the dirt. Help me, I said. Do we have enough time, Papa? He sounded only mildly interested. I don't know, maybe. Don't just stand there. Help me. The extra shovel was leaning against the side of the barn beside the splintered remains of the well cap. Henry grabbed it, and we began shoveling dirt and rocks out of the back of the truck as fast as ever we could. When the county sheriff's car with the gold star on the door and the spotlight on the roof pulled up by the chopping block, once more putting George and the chickens to flight, Henry and I were sitting on the porch steps with our shirts off and sharing the last thing Arlette James had ever made, a pitcher of lemonade. Sheriff Jones got out, hitched up his belt, took off his Stetson, brushed back his graying hair, and resettled his hat along the line where the white skin of his brow ended and coppery red took over. He was by his lonesome. I took that as a good sign. Good day, gents. He took in our bare chests, dirty hands, and sweaty faces. Hard chorin' this afternoon, is it? I spat. My own damn fault. Is that so? One of our cows fell in the old livestock well, Henry said. Jones asked again, Is that so? It is, I said. Would you want a glass of lemonade, Sheriff? It's Arlette's. Arlette's, is it? She decided to come back, did she? No, I said. She took her favorite clothes but left the lemonade. Have some. I will. But first I need to use your privy. Since I turned 55 or so, seems like I have to wee on every bush. It's a goddamned inconvenience. It's around the back of the house. Just follow the path and look for the crescent moon on the door. He laughed as though this were the funniest joke he'd heard all year, and went around the house. Would he pause on his way to look in the windows? He would if he was any good at his job, and I'd heard he was, at least in his younger days. Papa, Henry said. He spoke in a low voice. I looked at him. If he finds out, we can't do anything else. I can lie, but there can't be any more killing. All right, I said. That was a short conversation, but one I have pondered often in the 8 years since. Sheriff Jones came back, buttoning his fly. Go in and get the sheriff a glass, I told Henry. Henry went. Jones finished with his fly, took off his hat, brushed back his hair some more, and reset the hat. His badge glittered in the early afternoon sun. The gun on his hip was a big one, and although Jones was too old to have been in the Great War, the holster looked like AEF property. Maybe it was his son's. His son had died over there. Sweet-smelling privy, he said. Always nice on a hot day. Arlette used to put the quicklime to it pretty constantly, I said. I'll try to keep up the practice, if she stays away. Come on up to the porch and we'll sit in the shade. Shade sounds good, but I believe I'll stand. Need to stretch out my spine. I sat in my rocker with the paw cushion on it. He stood beside me, looking down. I didn't like being in that position, but tried to bear up patiently. Henry came out with a glass. Sheriff Jones poured his own lemonade, tasted, then gulped most of it down at a go and smacked his lips.
Good, isn't it?
Not too sour, not too sweet, just right. He laughed.
I'm like Goldilocks, aren't I?
He drank the rest but shook his head when Henry offered to refill his glass.
You want me pissing on every fence post on the way back to Hemmingford home? And then all the way to Hemmingford City after that?
Have you moved your office? I asked. I thought you were right there in the home.
I am, aren't I? The day they make me move the sheriff's office to the county seat is the day I resign and let Hap Birdwell take over like he wants to. No, no, it's just a court hearing up to the city. Amounts to no more than paperwork, but there it is. And you know how Judge Cripps is. Or no, I guess you don't, being a law-abiding sort. He's bad-tempered. And if a fellow isn't on time, his temper gets worse. So even though it comes down to just saying, so help me God, and then signing my name to a bunch of legal folderol, I have to hurry right along with my business out here, don't I? And hope my goddamn Maxie doesn't break down on the way back.
I said nothing to this. He didn't talk like a man who was in a hurry, but perhaps that was just his way. He took his hat off and brushed his hair back some more, but this time he didn't put the hat back on. He looked at me earnestly, then at Henry, then back at me again.
Guess you know I'm not out here on my own hook. I believe the doings between a man and his wife are their own business. It has to be that way, doesn't it?
Bible says the man is the head of a woman, and that if a woman should learn anything, it should be taught by her husband at home. Book of Corinthians. If the Bible was my only boss, I'd do things the Bible's way, and life would be simpler.
I'm surprised Mr. Lester's not out here with you, I said. Oh, he wanted to come, but I put the kibosh on that. He also wanted me to get a search warrant, but I told him I didn't need one. I said you'd either let me look around or you wouldn't.
He shrugged. His face was placid, but the eyes were keen and always in motion, peeking and prying, prying and peeking. When Henry asked me about the well, I'd said, we'll watch him and decide how sharp he is. If he's sharp, we'll show him ourselves. We can't look as if we have anything to hide. If you see me flick my thumb, that means I think we have to take the chance. But we have to agree, Hank. If I don't see you flick yours back, I'll keep my mouth shut. I raised my glass and drank the last of my lemonade. When I saw Henry looking at me, I flicked my thumb, just a little. It could have been a muscle twitch.
What does that Lester think? Henry asked, sounding indignant. That we got her tied up in the cellar?
His own hands stayed at his sides, not moving. Sheriff Jones laughed heartily, his big belly shaking behind his belt.
I don't know what he's thinking, do I? I don't care much either. Lawyers are fleas on the hide of human nature. I can say that because I've worked for them, and against them, that too, my whole adult life. But
the keen eyes fastened on mine.
I wouldn't mind a look just because you wouldn't let him look. He's pretty hot under the collar about that.
Henry scratched his arm. His thumb flicked twice as he did it. I didn't let him in the house because I took against him, I said. Although, to be fair, I guess I would have taken against John the Apostle if he came out here batting for Cole Farrington's team. Sheriff Jones laughed big at that.
Ha ha ha!
But his eyes didn't laugh. I stood up. It was a relief to be on my feet. Standing, I had 3 or 4 inches on Jones. You can look to your heart's content.
I appreciate that. It'll make my life a lot easier, won't it? I've got Judge Cripps to deal with when I go back, and that's enough. Don't need to listen to one of Farrington's legal beagles yapping at me, not if I can help it.
We went into the house with me leading and Henry bringing up the rear. After a few complimentary remarks about how neat the sitting room was and how tidy the kitchen was, we walked down the hall. Sheriff Jones had a perfunctory peek into Henry's room, and then we arrived at the main attraction. I pushed open the door to our bedroom with a queer sense of certainty. The blood would be back. It would be pooled on the floor, splashed on the walls, and soaking into the new mattress. Sheriff Jones would look, Then he would turn to me, remove the handcuffs that sat on his meaty hip across from his revolver, and say, "I'm arresting you for the murder of Arlette James, aren't I?" There was no blood and no smell of blood because the room had had days to air out. The bed was made, although not the way Arlette made it. My way was more army style, although my feet had kept me out of the war that had taken the sheriff's son. "Can't go kill krauts if you have flat feet. Men with flat feet can only kill wives." "Lovely room," Sheriff Jones remarked. "Gets the early light, doesn't it?" "Yes," I said. "And stays cool most afternoons, even in summer, because the sun's over on the other side." I went to the closet and opened it. That sense of certainty returned stronger than ever. "Where's the quilt?" he'd say. "The one that belongs there in the middle of the top shelf." He didn't, of course, but he came forward with alacrity when I invited him to. His sharp eyes, bright green, almost feline, went here, there, and everywhere. "Lots of duds," he said. "Yes," I admitted. Arlette liked clothes, and she liked the mail-order catalogs. "But since she only took the one valise, we have two, and the other one's still there. See it, in the back corner? I'd have to say she only took the ones she liked the best, and the ones that were practical, I suppose. She had two pairs of slacks and a pair of blue denims, and those are gone, even though she didn't care for pants. Pants are good for traveling in, though, aren't they? Man or woman, pants are good for traveling. And a woman might choose them, if she was in a hurry, that is. I suppose." "She took her good jewelry and her picture of Nana and Pop-Pop," Henry said from behind us. I jumped a little. I'd almost forgotten he was there. "Did she now? Well, I suppose she would." He took another flick through the clothes, then closed the closet door. "Nice room," he said, trudging back toward the hall with his Stetson in his hands. "Nice house. Woman'd have to be crazy to leave a nice room in a nice house like this." "Mama talked about the city a lot," Henry said, and sighed. "She had the idea of opening some kind of shop."
"Did she?"
Sheriff Jones regarded him brightly with his green cat's eyes.
"Well, but a thing like that takes money, doesn't it?"
"She's got those acres from her father," I said.
"Yes, yes,"
smiling bashfully as if he'd forgotten those acres.
"And maybe it's for the best. Better to be living in a wasteland than with a bitter-tongued, angry woman. Book of Proverbs."
"Are you glad she's gone, son?"
"No,"
Henry said, and tears overspilled his eyes. "I blessed each one." Sheriff Jones said,
"There, there."
And after offering that perfunctory comfort, he bent down with his hands braced on his pudgy knees and looked under the bed.
"Appears to be a pair of women's shoes under there. Broke in, too. The kind that would be good for walking. Don't suppose she ran away barefooty, do you?"
"She wore her canvas shoes," I said. "Those are the ones that are gone." They were, too. The faded green ones she used to call her gardening shoes. I'd remembered them just before starting to fill in the well.
"Ah," he said, "another mystery solved."
He pulled a silver-plated watch from his vest pocket and consulted it.
"Well, I'd better get on the roll. Tempest is fugiting right along."
We went back through the house, Henry bringing up the rear, perhaps so he could swipe his eyes dry in privacy. We walked with the sheriff toward his Maxwell sedan with the star on the door. I was about to ask him if he wanted to see the well. I even knew what I was going to call it. When he stopped and gave my son a look of frightening kindness.
"I stopped at the Cotteries," he said.
"Oh?" Henry said. "Did you?"
"Told you. These days I have to water just about every bush. But I'll use a privy any time there's one handy. Always assuming folks keep it clean and I don't have to worry about wasps while I'm waiting for my dingus to drip a little water. And the Cotteries are clean folks. Pretty daughter, too. Just about your age, isn't she?"
"Yes, sir," Henry said, lifting his voice just a tiny bit on the sir.
"Kind of sweet on her, I guess. And her on you, from what her mama says."
"Did she say that?" Henry asked.
He sounded surprised, but pleased, too.
Yes. Mrs. Cottery said you were troubled about your own mama, and that Shannon had told her something you said on that subject. I asked her what it was, and she said it wasn't her place to tell. But I could ask Shannon, so I did.
Henry looked at his feet. I told her to keep it to herself.
You aren't going to hold it against her, are you?
Sheriff Jones asked.
I mean, when a big man like me, with a star on his chest, asks a little thing like her what she knows, it's kind of hard for the little thing to keep mum, isn't it? She just about has to tell, doesn't she?
I don't know, Henry said, still looking down. Probably. He wasn't just acting unhappiness. He was unhappy, even though it was going just the way we had hoped it would.
Shannon says your ma and your pop here had a big fight about selling those 100 acres. And when you came down on your papa's side, Mrs. James slapped you up pretty good.
Yes, Henry said colorlessly. She'd had too much to drink. Sheriff Jones turned to me.
Was she drunk or just tiddly?
Somewhere in between, I said. If she'd been all the way to drunk, she would have slept all night instead of getting up and packing a grip and creeping away like a thief.
Thought she'd come back once she sobered up, did you?
I did. It's over 4 miles out to the Tarvey. I thought for sure she'd come back. Someone must have come along and given her a ride before her head cleared. A trucker on the Lincoln Omaha run would be my guess.
Yep, that'd be mine too.
You'll hear from her when she contacts Mr. Lester, I'm sure.
If she means to stay out on her own, if she's got that in her head, she'll need money to do it.
So he knew that, too. His eyes sharpened.
Did she have any money at all, Mr. James?
Well,
don't be shy. Confession's good for the soul. The Catholics have got hold of something there, don't they?
I kept a box in my dresser. There was $200 put by in it. To help pay the pickers when they start next month.
And Mr. Cottery,
Henry reminded. To Sheriff Jones, he said, Mr. Cottery has a corn harvester, a Harris Giant, almost new. It's a pip.
Yep, saw it in his dooryard. Big bastard, isn't it? Pardon my Polish. Money all gone out in that box, was it?
I smiled sourly. Only it wasn't really me making that smile. The conniving man had been in charge ever since Sheriff Jones pulled up by the chopping block.
She left 20. Very generous of her. But 20's all Harlan Cottery will ever take for the use of his harvester, so that's all right. And when it comes to the pickers, I guess Stoppenhauser at the bank will advance me a shorty loan, unless he owes favors to the Farrington Company, that is. Either way, I've got my best farmhand right here.
I tried to ruffle Henry's hair. He ducked away, embarrassed.
Well, I've got a good budget of news to tell Mr. Lester, don't I? He won't like any of it, but if he's as smart as he thinks he is, I guess he'll know enough to expect her in his office and sooner rather than later. People have a way of turning up when they're short on folding green, don't they?
That's been my experience, I said. If we're done here, Sheriff, my boy and I better get back to work. That useless well should have been filled in 3 years ago. An old cow of mine.
Elphys.
Henry spoke, like a boy in a dream.
Her name was Elphys.
Elphys, I agreed.
She got out of the barn and decided to take a stroll on the cap, and it gave way. Didn't have the good grace to die on her own either. I had to shoot her. Come around the back of the barn. I'll show you the wages of laziness with its damn feet sticking up.
We're going to bury her right where she lies, and from now on I'm going to call that old well Wilfred's Folly.
Well, I would, wouldn't I? It'd be something to see, but I've got that bad-tempered old judge to contend with.
Another time, he hoisted himself into the car, grunting as he did so.
Thank you for the lemonade and for being so gracious. You could have been a lot less so, considering who sent me out here.
That's all right, I said.
We all have our jobs. And our crosses to bear.
His sharp eyes fastened on Henry again.
Son, Mr. Lester told me you were hiding something. He was sure of it. And you were, weren't you?
Yes, sir, Henry said in his colorless and somehow awful voice.
as if all his emotions had flown away, like those things in Pandora's jar when she opened it. But there was no Elphus for Henry and me. Our Elphus was dead in the well.
"If he asks me, I'll tell him he was wrong," Sheriff Jones said. "A company lawyer don't need to know that a boy's mother put her hand to him while she was in drink."
He groped under his seat, came up with a long S-shaped tool I knew well, and held it out to Henry.
"Would you save an old man's back and shoulder, son?"
"Yes, sir. Happy to."
Henry took the crank and went around to the front of the Maxwell.
"Mind your wrist," Jones hollered. "She kicks like a bull."
Then he turned to me. The inquisitive glitter had gone out of his eyes. So had the green. They looked dull and gray and hard, like lake water on a cloudy day. It was the face of a man who could beat a railroad bum within an inch of his life and never lose a minute's sleep over it.
"Mr. James," he said, "I need to ask you something, man to man."
"All right," I said. I tried to brace myself for what I felt sure was coming next.
"Is there another cow in yonder well, one named Arlette?"
But I was wrong.
"I can put her name and description out on the telegraph wire, if you want. She won't have gone no further than Omaha, will she? Not on just 180 smackers. And a woman who spent most of her life keeping house has no idea of how to hide out. She'll like as not be in a rooming house over on the east side where they run cheap. I could have her brought back, dragged back by the hair of the head, if you want. That's a generous offer, but..."
The dull gray eyes surveyed me.
"Think it over before you say yea or nay. Sometimes a female needs talking to by hand, if you take my meaning. And after that, they're all right. A good whacking has a way of sweetening some gals up. Think it over."
"I will." The Maxwell's engine exploded into life. I stuck out my hand, the one that had cut her throat. But Sheriff Jones didn't notice. He was busy retarding the Maxwell's spark and adjusting her throttle. 2 minutes later, he was no more than a diminishing boil of dust on the farm road.
"He never even wanted to look," Henry marveled.
"No. And that turned out to be a very good thing." We had shoveled hard and fast when we saw him coming, and nothing stuck up now but one of Elphus's lower legs. The hoof was about 4 feet below the lip of the well. Flies circled it in a cloud. The sheriff would have marveled all right, and he would have marveled even more when the dirt in front of that protruding hoof began to pulse up and down. Henry dropped his shovel and grabbed my arm. The afternoon was hot, but his hand was ice cold.
"It's her," he whispered.
His face seemed to be nothing but eyes.
"She's trying to get out."
"Stop being such a goddamn ninny," I said. But I couldn't take my eyes off that circle of heaving dirt. It was as if the well were alive, and we were seeing the beating of its hidden heart. Then dirt and pebbles sprayed to either side, and a rat surfaced. The eyes, black as beads of oil, blinked in the sunshine. It was almost as big as a full-grown cat. Caught in its whiskers was a shred of blood-stained, brown burlap.
"Oh, you fuck!"
Henry screamed. Something whistled inches past my ear, and then the edge of Henry's shovel split the rat's head in two as it looked up into the dazzle.
"She sent it," Henry said.
He was grinning.
"The rats are hers now."
"No such thing. You're just upset." He dropped his shovel and went to the pile of rocks with which we meant to finish the job once the well was mostly filled in. There he sat down and stared at me raptly.
"Are you sure? Are you positive she ain't haunting us? People say someone who's murdered will come back to haunt whoever..."
"People say lots of things. Lightning never strikes twice in the same place. A broken mirror brings 7 years bad luck. A whippoorwill calling at midnight means someone in the family's going to die." I sounded reasonable, but I kept looking at the dead rat and that shred of blood-stained burlap, from her snood. She was still wearing it down there in the dark, only now there was a hole in it with her hair sticking up.
That look is all the rage among dead women this summer, I thought.
When I was a kid, I really believed that if I stepped on a crack, I'd break my mother's back, Henry said musingly. There, you see?
He brushed rock dust from the seat of his pants and stood beside me.
I got him, though. I got that fucker, didn't I?
You did. And because I didn't like how he sounded, no, not at all, I clapped him on the back. Henry was still grinning.
If the sheriff had come back here to look like you invited him and seen that rat come tunneling to the top, he might have had a few more questions, don't you think?
Something about this idea set Henry to laughing hysterically. It took him 4 or 5 minutes to laugh himself out, and he scared a murder of crows up from the fence that kept the cows out of the corn. But eventually he got past it. By the time we finished our work, it was past sundown, and we could hear owls comparing notes as they launched their pre-moonrise hunts from the barn loft. The rocks on top of the vanished well were tight together, and I didn't think any more rats would be squirming to the surface. We didn't bother replacing the broken cap. There was no need. Henry seemed almost like his normal self again, and I thought we both might get a decent night's sleep.
"What do you say to sausage, beans, and cornbread?" I asked him.
"Can I start the generator and play Hayride Party on the radio?"
"Yes, sir, you can."
He smiled at that. His old good smile.
Thanks, Papa.
I cooked enough for 4 farmhands, and we ate it all. 2 hours later, while I was deep in my sitting room chair and nodding over a copy of Silas Marner, Henry came in from his room, dressed in just his summer underdrawers. He regarded me soberly.
Mama always insisted on me saying my prayers. Did you know that?
I blinked at him, surprised.
Still?
No, I didn't.
Yes, even after she wouldn't look at me unless I had my pants on, because she said I was too old and it wouldn't be right. But I can't pray now, or ever again.